voting.
May it please the court, my name is Ivan Bodensteiner and I represent the plaintiff appellant, Mr. Furuhashi. This case arose out of a transaction at a truck stop on November 28th of 2001. Mr. Furuhashi claims that he was stopped, arrested, detained, and charged because of his race. In addition, he claims that he was charged with disorderly conduct and criminal trespass, and that there was not probable cause for an arrest based on either of those. I'll address the two key issues raised in this appeal. First of all, on the question of criminal trespass. The trial court concluded that factual disputes precluded the determination as to whether there was probable cause on disorderly conduct. And it's our contention that the same is true of the charge of criminal trespass, that the factual disputes preclude a determination that the officer had probable cause.
Well, there's the oddity that each side seems to be relying on the other's deposition testimony. If your client's deposition testimony is true, then there was probable cause. If the defendant's, at least Lindgren's, deposition testimony is true, then there wasn't.
I agree.
Each side says the other's testimony is an admission against interest and finding or something like that.
I agree, Your Honor. There is that element here. However, when you go through the elements of criminal trespass under Indiana law, and basically set out in the statute, I think that makes it a little more complex. In other words, Furuhashi's testimony doesn't defeat his argument as to all of those elements. And, you know, basically the Indiana statute, which I think is fairly common for criminal trespass, says that the person has no contractual interest in the property, knowingly and intentionally refuses to leave after having been asked to do so. It's that latter one where you really get conflicting testimony, where actually Mr. Lindner's testimony is the best for the plaintiff and Mr. Furuhashi's testimony is the best for the defendants.
Mr. Bodensteiner, that leads me to wonder, what exactly is a Flying J fuel card, and what rights and obligations does it impose upon the Flying J and upon the holder of the card?
Well, in one sense, I think it's just a credit card. In another sense, and the testimony is fairly sparse on this, no doubt about it. In other words, he has two bases for claiming a contractual relationship. The one relates to the fuel card and his agreement with the an executive officer of Flying J that he would use the fuel card and that he would in fact purchase his fuel from Flying J. So that's one part of it. Now, does the fuel card say you will not purchase from anyone else? I don't think so. but in other words, the Flying J official makes this offer to him. He accepts that. More specifically, however, I think there was a contractual obligation here that arose out of the transaction itself. He pulls up to the pump, phones in for the authorization.
Well, there may be a contractual obligation, but he doesn't have a contractual interest in the premises. If you show up at Marshall Fields and pick up a set of sheets, and as you're on your way to pay, if an official of Marshall Fields says, I demand that you leave the store this instant, and you say, but I want to pay, and Marshall Fields says, take the sheets and go, I don't think you would say you had a contractual interest in Marshall Fields' premises. You've been told to, sheets are yours. And of course, on the testimony here, your client was told, fuel is yours, go.
Depending on who one, whose
well,
testimony one accepts.
Come back to the question about the curious
trust
in whose testimony serves whose interest.
Exactly.
It's awfully hard to view the statement, I want to pay for something that they're content to give me for free, as a contractual interest in the premises.
Well, except that Lindner's testimony was that he wasn't giving it to him for free, that he says he in fact went out there, and this was another factual dispute, but Lindner says he
yeah,
went
he
out
and him to stay. We understand.
Escorted him in.
Then there was no trespass. No problem on that view.
Right. And so, but I think in terms of his contractual interest in being where he was in the lobby, I think that flows from the fact that he had an obligation to pay for the fuel he had pumped, and because he was not paying for it at the pump, he had to come into the facility, get in line, and make the payment. Now, the Indiana cases, and there seem to be three that the trial court discussed, the Olson case, the Woods case, and the ABE case, or AED rather, I'm sorry, talk about that contractual interest. You know, in the one case, the person was a Woods, was a member of a club. In another case, I think it was the Olson case, they had rented a room in a hotel. And then in AED, it was a question about a student and the school. But for purposes of the statute, they do discuss this as a contractual interest in the property, and I guess more specifically, a contractual interest in being in the property at that particular time. And so in the Olson case, where we're talking about the hotel, the court distinguishes between his interest in the room he had leased as opposed to the lobby, and he was in the lobby at the time of the problem, not for purposes of renting his room, but he comes down there a couple times, most recently at 3 in the morning, gets in an argument, et cetera, et cetera. And at that point, the court says, look, they were entitled to excuse him and ask him to leave. Here we don't even have that triggering event. I mean, the evidence is very conflicting as to what actually happened. If you take one version of it, it was a rather low-key discussion. And so it wasn't a matter of his disrupting other customers or putting anyone in fear or anything like that. And so, you know, his position then is that he had a contractual interest based on having pumped the gas to be there to pay for it. And the court also talked about the mens rea part of it, what the Indiana law says, and this is found most clearly in the AEB case, is that the state has to show the requisite intent, and that if the person has a reasonable belief of a right to be on the property at the time, that means there's no requisite intent to satisfy the statute and therefore no probable cause. And the Indiana law also says that it's up to the jury to make that determination. So it's our position that just like with disorderly conduct, the factual disputes as to what actually happened here preclude a determination that the trial court made, that is, that there was in fact probable cause for the arrest, and therefore Officer Williams was entitled to qualified immunity defense. Switching to the race issue, I think one of the key concerns here relates to the meaning of this court's decision in the Morris v. Office Max case. This court has said on a number of occasions that a Section 1981 plaintiff can use the so-called direct method of proof or the indirect method of proof. Here it's our position that there's evidence to satisfy the direct method, or, you know, again, enough evidence for the matter to go to the jury, based on the comment that was made to Mr. Purvarashi by Officer Williams in the context of making the arrest. I'm going to send...
Yeah, how does that help you, though, against Lindgren? Is there any reason in this record to believe that Lindgren knew or suspected that your client was non-white?
As opposed to
Iranian or anything else?
As opposed to Williams, you
yes.
mean?
The he has a stronger claim against Williams in light of what Williams said, but
right.
what Williams says after he's got your client by the collar doesn't reflect on Lindgren.
Well, I think the evidence there, Your Honor, is the declaration of Mr. Graddick, who represented poor Hirashi in the criminal charge on the criminal charges, and his declaration says that based on the both appearance and speech, that it was obvious that he was not, I believe his words were, not Caucasian.
But your own client says it is not evident from his appearance or speech, and Lindgren said the same.
Well, yes.
Where is the factual dispute coming from in this record? I understand where the factual dispute is coming from on trespass.
Right. I think.
But on appearance and accent, your client and Lindgren appear to be in perfect agreement. That is, he's indistinguishable.
Except that our client also testified that people do, when they see him, assume that he's not from this country. So, his statements are less than clear on that, obviously. But again, if you take the combination of factors that Williams obviously knew, and he had the same vantage point as Lindner, and you combine that with the Graddick's testimony or declaration, and I think our point is that that's enough to send that matter to the jury as to both of the both Lindner and Williams. And then secondly, or maybe more importantly, with respect to the actual approach to this under the OfficeMax case, I think the OfficeMax case, I think, has been utilized and was utilized here by the district court in a way that was never intended in OfficeMax, nor was it stated in In other words, OfficeMax talked about what a plaintiff has to prove to win a case, and the trial court and some other courts have taken that to mean that OfficeMax says under the indirect method, as part of a prima facie case, you have to show intent. And as we point out in our brief, that's the indirect method is basically a way of showing intentional discrimination.
Right, but the indirect method, again, assumes, back to my question, that the person who's acting knows that the person is a member of the protected class.
I understand that.
If somebody applies for employment at SBC Communications and SBC rejects it on the paper without having any clue whether he's black, white, Iranian, he wouldn't be able to go anywhere under the indirect method, right?
I understand that, Jan, and I guess that goes back to what I said earlier, that there, we believe there is sufficient evidence for the jury to find that Lindner in fact knew, when you take the combination of what Williams said and the combination or add that to what Graddick said, that a reasonable jury could conclude that Lindner was intentionally burying his head in the sand here, that he simply knew. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Lotus Honor. Mr. Bielski?
May it please the Court, my name is Ed Bielski, and I represent Fang J Incorporated with regard to this matter. Mr. Weirich will be discussing, speaking second. He represents Nacon Security and Officer Williams. I'll be taking about 8 or 9 minutes. Mr. Weirich will be taking about 7. Your Honors, I'll be discussing Section 19...
Are you representing Mr. Lindgren?
Yes, Your Honor, I am. I'll be discussing the 1981 claims. Mr. Weirich will be discussing the probable cause issues. Your Honors, the most basic component of any Section 1981 claim can't be the mere existence of race and ethnicity. As Judge Easterbrook pointed out, it has to include the defendant's knowledge of that race and ethnicity. We hear all the time in the media these days about playing the race card. And I would acknowledge that can have different political and legal ramifications, but we can all agree that at base level, you can't play the race card. You can't bring a race card out from under your sleeve that only you know about and claim that it survived summary judgment. Today I'm going to be talking about three things. One, that the trial court properly ruled for summary judgment in favor of the defendants based upon this court's ruling and standard set in Morris versus OfficeMax. Second, that the indirect method proposed by plaintiffs is inappropriate in this setting for two reasons. One, because of the hidden race issue in this case, and two, because this is a retail setting, which is quite different than the employment law cases that are usually evaluated, 1981 claims. And finally, no matter what standard this court uses, summary judgment is still appropriate. This court sets a standard in Morris.
Let me stop you for a minute. I don't know if you or Mr. Bielski...
I'm Mr. Bielski.
No, I know. I'm sorry. I don't know if you or Mr. Rurick. I'm sorry. Was going to, respond, but you mentioned summary judgment. And, in this circuit, we've said time and time again that self-serving statements are indeed an acceptable method for a non-moving party to present evidence of disputed material facts. And Mr. Perugarashi stated that Officer Williams told him he was going to send him back to his country. He also stated that he didn't provide any incorrect testimony or incorrect information prior to fueling, and so he shouldn't have been under any more suspicion than the similarly situated Caucasian truck drivers who left the payment line to go to the restroom. And both of these pieces of evidence are based on his personal knowledge, and they set forth disputed facts showing that there is a genuine issue for trial. How is it that this evidence shouldn't defeat your motion for summary judgment?
Well, Your Honor, specifically with regard to the quintessential statement in this case, which is, I'm going to send you back to your own country. Let's go ahead and assume that that statement took place. The trial court correctly determined that even if that statement took place, summary judgment was appropriate. And here's why. I'm going to send you back to your own country. Stand alone. Well, what country is that, Your Honors? Is it Australia? Is it Canada? Is it Greece?
I'm sure he didn't think that it was Chicago.
Indeed, Your Honor. But at base level, let's take that statement for what it means. I'm going to send you back to your own country, which
means he has detected that this person has probably a non-European ethnicity.
I disagree, Your Honor.
Seems unlikely that statements of that sort are made to people, say, known to be from the United Kingdom.
I would disagree with that, Your Honor, in that this statement, standing alone, merely suggests that he knows or assumes that he is from, originally, a country other than the United States, whether that's Greece, which is European, and I don't think that there is a distinguishing element here, or whether that's Kosovo. And again, I don't know that there is a distinguishing element that you could determine that. Either way, all he says is that I'm going to send you back to your own country. What this court should assume from that, and what the evidence suggests...
One inference that one could draw is that Williams, at least, saw something out of the ordinary about the plaintiff. Now, one might be able to infer from that Lindgren saw something out of the ordinary about the plaintiff.
I don't think one could possibly infer that, Your Honor. And let me address...
Lindgren is visually impaired?
No, Your Honor, because there's...
And you can see whatever Williams saw.
Well, Your Honor, when you're talking about visually impaired, that's an important distinction, because there are only three people involved with this discussion. Each of those three people stated the exact same three thing, that visually, there's no distinction between Mr. Perugarashi and any other Caucasian citizen in the United States. Mr. Lindgren testified to that, Officer Williams testified to that, but most importantly, Mr. Perugarashi said, there's nothing about me visually that is any different than anyone else. So when you're talking about that perception issue, again, you're talking at most the existence of an accent. And also you're talking about, at most, the inference that if someone from outside the United States, and this court ruled in the Amelia versus Hilton case, that country of origin is insufficient to establish a 1981 claim. In this situation, the most you can make from that statement is that he is from another country of origin. Certainly not that he is Iranian in this case, because that is a secret only known to Mr. Perugarashi. This case is vitally distinct from other employment law cases. In employment law cases, you've got a situation where someone files an application, where the name is known, when there are ongoing contractual relationships, when there are ongoing discussions that occur. And in those situations, sure, then you know someone's Iranian. Then you know there might be some ethnic background that might be an issue. But when you're talking about a retail setting, when there's quick movement in and out, individual decisions.
Yeah, but there are also white patrons who left the line as well and were not hassled.
But
I mean, it isn't just, you know, go back to your own country. There is other options here.
Indeed, Your Honor, but the distinction is that there's absolutely no indication that those white patrons were similarly situated.
But there's no evidence that they weren't similarly situated.
Indeed, but the burden is plaintiff's to prove that.
But
it's not defendant's burden to prove that. Plaintiff must establish that they're similarly situated. In this situation, there are just no reason to know that those white patrons that were allegedly in line had actually fueled.
Well, but Judge Lozano explained that there was no evidence that Lindgren, for instance, believed that the drivers also had given incorrect information prior to pumping gas. But he credited the defendants and not the plaintiff's story on that point. And
well, again, you know,
go ahead.
Your Honor, I would simply suggest let's look who has the burden of proof. The plaintiff has the burden of proof to establish his case. If there's no evidence, well, then that favors the defendant.
Yeah, but see, Mr. Puragashi denied providing false information. It's the defendants who claim that they believe that he had provided false information. Never in the brief did I note that it was stated that he did provide incorrect information, only that they believe that he did. So,
well, again, Your Honor, it goes, our position is that he did provide false information. He claims that he did not. Either way, that doesn't affect what eventually happened. When you're talking about discrimination...
The question I was going to ask when I realized I was interrupting my colleague and therefore clamped up is, what is the status of the record about whether the plaintiff concedes that the defendant's belief about false information was honest?
Well, I think...
If there was a mistaken belief, but it was an actual and honest belief, now, digits were transposed by the cashier, so the cashier thought he had given a bogus number, even though he'd given a correct one. Or he transposed the digits and didn't realize he'd given an incorrect one. I mean, what's the status of the record about, is there a dispute about the honesty of the belief that the information was false?
I don't think there is a dispute about that. In fact, plaintiff specifically testified that Mr. Lindgren clearly thought that he'd given false information. In fact, the testimony also shows that when he was back in that office, Mr. Puragashi kept saying, well, Mr. Lindgren kept coming back and accusing me of giving false information. Now, whether that's an honest mistake or not is really not the central issue here. The central issue, as the court correctly points out, is did they have this belief? And I don't think there's any suggestion that they didn't have this belief, and especially when you're talking about racial animus. There has to be some indication of racial animus in this situation. There's absolutely nothing that Mr. Lindgren said that could even possibly be equated to racial animus. Not even a word, not even a hint. The only racial animus that's even remotely possible is that which was stated by Officer Williams. And Officer Williams merely said, we're going to send you back to your own country. Additionally, courts have determined that a single racial statement, or allegedly racial statement, is insufficient to establish discrimination. Thank you,
Thank you. Mr.
May it please the court. When we look at the probable cause issue, regardless of whether it's a 1983 analysis or the state law, false arrest and false imprisonment, it's important to make sure we're clear on the factual chronology in this case. Initially, the plaintiff was interacting with Mr. Lundgren. That interaction related to the belief that Mr. Lundgren had about the misinformation. Mr. Williams was not aware of that dispute. he heard an argument.
Well, Mr. Williams may not have been aware of that dispute, but as I understand the current state of the record, Lindgren says that not only did he not tell the plaintiff to go, he also told Williams there was no problem with his being there and not to arrest him. And that Williams then said in his own deposition, well, I told him to go and I arrested him when he didn't. Now, I don't think under the law of trespass of any state you lose your right to be on premises when a police officer or a security officer tells you to go, speaking on his own hook.
This
was in this very odd for a police officer to say, I told him to go, he didn't follow my direction, so I arrested him, when he had no actual authority to tell him to go.
No, Your Honor, the record is clear that he did have authority to tell him go. This was not a police officer who was just on his beat and happened to go in.
The security officer had the authority to contradict the manager of the gas station.
Yes. Both Lundgren and Williams testified
to that. The security officer was really in charge and the manager was his subordinate. I didn't see an organizational chart in your brief. That's the most unusual organizational chart.
We didn't testify in that sense, but Lundgren and Williams both testified that Williams had the authority to tell Pergashi to leave. Mr. Pergashi also testified that he believed once Williams came on the scene, Williams was in charge.
I find it very confusing that a plaintiff can be arrested for trespass because he refused to leave, even though he was in the facility in order to pay for gas that he just put in his truck. I mean, it creates a very strange situation in which Lindgren can ask him to leave, threaten him with a trespass arrest for not leaving, and then he's arrested for theft of gas when he leaves without paying. I mean, doesn't he have the right to remain long enough to pay the bill?
Well, that was the point I was trying to make, Your Honor, is why it's important to separate the time period between when Lundgren was talking and when Williams was talking. If they were both there giving Pergashi contradictory instructions at exactly the same time, that might obviate probable cause. And it may be that if this case went to trial in a criminal sense, Mr. Pergashi would be able to point to Mr. Lundgren's testimony and that would be enough to provide reasonable doubt. But we're not talking about reasonable doubt, we're talking about simply probable cause. And when we look at the elements that Mr. Williams was aware of, those elements were satisfied. Judge Lozano concluded those elements were satisfied, and we believe the record is very clear that those elements are satisfied. And specifically as to trespass, that there's no contractual interest in the property, that he knowingly or intentionally refused to leave after being instructed to do so. Williams instructed him to leave. Pergashi testified that he was so instructed. He understood the instruction. He chose not to because he wanted to pay. As Judge Lozano said, simply because he wanted to stick around and pay doesn't obviate the elements of trespass, particularly with regard to the establishment of the probable cause. It may be that he would have had a defense if the case went to trial, but that's not...
But wait a minute. Isn't he arrested for theft of gas when he leaves without paying?
That didn't happen. Are you asking, could he have been?
No.
You're asking, was he arrested for theft? No, he was arrested for disorderly conduct and trespass.
No, the question is, wasn't Williams trying to set him up on that understanding?
Right.
Giving an instruction such that whether it was obeyed or disobeyed,
right,
he would be arrested.
No,
if it was obeyed, he would be arrested for theft of gas. If it was disobeyed, he'd be arrested for trespass.
And again, this goes back to why it's important to separate the conversations between Lundgren and the conversations with Williams. That was separate. Williams wasn't aware of that. He came up and just heard an argument, said, get out. He had authority.
That's very Alice in Wonderland, isn't it?
Well, again, you have to go back to what Williams knew.
And back to the question whether Williams had actual authority to make the plaintiff a gift of $160 worth of gas by telling him to leave and excusing non-payment. Because if he didn't have that actual authority to trump the manager and give away Flying J's gasoline, or diesel fuel, then his instruction could not have been effectual.
I think that assumes that he knew that Pergunsky had pumped gas and was had to pay for it still. And I don't think the record's clear.
Well, the response, my client spoke first, you know, did not follow the instruction, engage brain before putting mouth in gear, somehow doesn't seem to help him very much.
Perhaps a different situation would have come out if he had been aware of exactly what was told between the flying J representative and Mr. Pergunsky. At the same time, Schertz and a number of other cases out of the Seventh Circuit make clear that there is no duty to thoroughly investigate. Once you have probable cause, you can stop. Once he had probable cause by telling him to leave, he didn't. There was no evidence.
That's the question, whether a security officer or a police officer can create his own probable cause by creating the crime for which he makes the arrest.
When he is stationed there as a security guard and has legal authority as opposed to a beat officer, well, that's his job to be there, he certainly can.
And don't you think it's a little odd to describe the sale of gasoline in this case as having been completed in a fair manner? I mean, is it really fair to take money out of a person's pocket while he's handcuffed and under police custody so long as you give him a receipt for the transaction?
Well,
I mean, if that happened to me over at Marshall Field, I'd be very upset.
Yeah, I can certainly understand that, Your Honor. I think the point of that part of the brief was to point out the fact that to the extent plaintiff is arguing that he had a contractual right to purchase the gas, that, quote, contract, wouldn't believe it's a contract, but to the extent it was, that was effectuated. He did purchase the gas. He paid what he was supposed to pay.
While handcuffed and under custody.
Right, but in the situation where probable cause did exist for his arrest. So to the extent that a contract claim or a 1981 claim might try to survive, even though there was probable cause, that would undermine that.
But can you see where someone, knowing all this, might think that in part he really was arrested for theft of gas?
No,
when,
he was...
When they, you know, go into his pockets, take the money, give him a receipt, he's handcuffed. I mean, you can't see that at all.
He can perceive a bunch of things, but that doesn't determine what probable cause is. So, I see that my time is up, Your Honor. Thank you. We would request that the court affirm the district court's ruling.
Thank you, Mr. Larry. Mr. Bodenstein?
Just one point. Judge Easterbrook asked whether there was anything in the record from which one could question what Lindner said his belief was about the information, the false information. And I think the answer is yes, in that Lindner and his testimony was very detailed about how he had some information, went out to the truck, remembered all the numbers, and concluded that there was something wrong. And I think one could question his ability to remember that, particularly in light of the fact when he asked...
Did you question it in the district court?
Pardon?
Did you question it in the district court?
Well, we questioned it in this sense.
You say in the district court that we think it's a disputed issue of material fact whether Lindgren had an honest belief that false information had been given.
I don't know if we used the term an honest belief, but I think we certainly pointed out that when asked what the false information, what false information was given, he had no idea. And I think from that, the jury could conclude that that was simply manufactured.
But didn't he say that he had been alerted to this by the cashier?
Yes, he said that.
So if what's going on is that digits have been transposed or something like that, you wouldn't expect the manager to understand it.
Well, you wouldn't expect him to necessarily remember the digits at the point of the deposition, but I think you, in light of the fact that he claims he did know the digits, then you would at least expect him to be able to say, well, he gave the wrong number. Whether he could recite the numbers or not, yeah, I wouldn't expect him to be able to do that, but at least I would think he could. This is the key to his case. He should have been able to articulate what was given that was false. Thank you.
Thanks, Bernstein. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed to...